I'm Lauren Bennett. These are my colleagues, Janora and Flora. It's really just going to be me and Janora talking about regression analysis right now. Flora's here mainly for moral support. We appreciate it. So we want to talk about regression analysis, and I think, so how many people here do regression analysis all the time? Okay. How many of you are new to regression analysis? Okay. So for those of you who didn't see, we had about just as many people raise their hand and say they do regression analysis all the time as we had people raise their hand and say they are new to regression analysis. I just want everybody to understand where we're at, which is that this will hopefully be useful to everybody, those of you who know more about regression analysis than I do, and those of you who are new to regression analysis. Our goal with this workshop is that you'll walk away, if you're new to regression analysis, feeling like, you know what, I could totally do this. And if you're a veteran regression analysis expert, that you walk away with an understanding of how we've implemented regression analysis in ArcGIS and what it kind of means to think spatially about regression analysis if maybe you're not currently incorporating geography as much into some of the regression analysis that you're doing. So we're going to talk specifically about a couple of things. One is ordinary least squares regression. And in the context of ordinary least squares regression, we're going to be talking about what we call the six checks. These are the things that you have to do in order to feel confident that you found a model that you can trust. And we're also going to be talking about geographically weighted regression. A geographically weighted regression, of which I'll be calling GWR from now on. GWR is a really powerful tool that allows us to kind of build on what we learn using OLS and start to take some geography into account in our regression analysis. So we're going to start by setting the context because we're going to use one analysis to walk through this workshop this afternoon. I will say just kind of as an important note, this is real data that we're going to look at that Janora is going to show us, and every aspect of it is real data that we did in a real analysis of. We tried to find a properly specified model. But I'll say, of course, it's also a demo. So for those of you who are working, we're looking at Medicare expenditure, and for those of you who work in this field, my guess is you'd get a better model than us. You'd ask better questions. You'd think of better data to include, and that's awesome. If you walk away thinking like, I could totally improve on the work that they did, that would be exactly what we would think you'd be walking away. Our goal with using this data set and this analysis is to use it as an example to show you how regression analysis works, not to show you how great we are at analysis. It's just a demo, right? So with that, we'll set the context for the demo. Janora is going to show us
okay, so what we're looking at here is a map of Medicare spending per capita by hospital referral region for the whole U.S. It's a hotspot map, and it has identified some statistically significant clusters of low Medicare spending, such as up here in the Pacific Northwest, and it's also identified some significantly high Medicare spending, such as this area in the south. But ideally, we would hope that these services were being provided equitably across the country, but it doesn't seem that way, and so we're going to investigate why using regression analysis. So the question is, why do we spend more in Medicare in some places than in others? So the first thing that comes to mind is, well, maybe the people in these areas where we're spending more money, maybe they're getting better care, and better care costs more money, and that is what's happening.
Did anybody think that that might be the reason?
So one way to check that hypothesis very quickly is by checking and looking at hospital readmission rates. The idea being that if someone is readmitted to the hospital within 30 days with the same condition, that they didn't receive adequate care in the first place. So we're just going to visually check and visually compare these two maps of hospital readmission rate and our hotspot analysis map. We're going to use the swipe tool. So in purple are our hospital readmission rates, and then we have our hotspot map underneath. And it looks like in the Pacific Northwest, they have low Medicare spending, but then they also have low readmission rates. In that hot spot in the south, it actually looks like they have higher readmission rates, which means that they're actually getting worse care. So that didn't answer our question.
Well, it did. It's just...
Now we have more questions. What's happening? So we're going to get started and learn about regression analysis.
Yes.
See if we can answer this question.
Okay. So what is regression analysis? We kind of think about regression analysis in a couple of ways, and that there's kind of different... We use regression analysis for different reasons, right? So we may be using regression analysis to explore spatial relationships. I mean, that's pretty much... That's always a big part of what we're doing, and to understand the factors behind the spatial patterns that we're seeing. Sometimes we're most interested in predicting outcomes based on that understanding. Other times we're not as much interested in predicting outcomes as we are about understanding the factors, so it really kind of depends. We can also kind of think about it as this process that we use to estimate the relationships between variables. So in the simplest form, you could think of something like a scatter plot as this way of thinking about the relationships that we're trying to find. Now, we really break down why we use regression analysis into these three buckets. Now, the first one might be to explore correlations. And we kind of think about this as casually exploring correlations, because this way of thinking about regression analysis, it is quite casual, and it should be thought of that way. Because if you haven't found a model that you can trust, for instance, and you're just looking at correlations, like just looking at a scatter plot, for instance, it can be very dangerous to look at those correlations and think that you're actually finding the factors that are related to this underlying phenomenon that you're modeling, right? So that's the casual correlations. Then you might be just trying to predict unknown values. So it's, you know, if you're trying to predict rainfall and you know that there's these really strong relationships between rainfall, temperature, and elevation, and you have some locations where you have rainfall values, and then you have elevation and temperature at all locations, you could use the relationships to estimate where you don't have rain gauges, right? So if you have a really good model that does a really good job of predicting, it doesn't even matter what the relationships are. All you care about is how close can I get to predicting rainfall. I don't care if the variables I'm using are actually factors related to why it rains. If they're doing a really good job predicting, then they're doing a really good job predicting. If I'm predicting well, I'm predicting well. And if that's your whole goal, regression analysis can be valuable for that. But the thing that gets us really excited, and I think the reason that it's the reason that a lot of you are here, is because one of our real goals is to understand key factors. We want to understand the underlying factors for a particular phenomenon that we're modeling, because if we understand those factors, it means we might be able to do something about it. If we know that childhood obesity and accessibility of healthy food have a relationship, and accessibility of healthy food truly is a factor for childhood obesity, then we can make healthy food more accessible and actually change the outcomes. And so understanding those key factors is valuable, and it's one of the big reasons why finding a model that you can trust and those six checks are so important. And it's why we're going to spend so much time talking about those six checks today, because only when we've found a model that we can trust can we really start to think about those relationships being meaningful. So for a little brevity, and because it is really important to be careful with correlations, we might, for instance, find that the divorce rate in Maine is quite strongly related to per capita consumption of margarine. I feel pretty strongly that margarine probably actually isn't related to divorce, but I guess you never know. Okay, margarine is gross, agreed. But I would love my husband even if he ate it. Fair enough. Or, for instance, there's a real pretty strong relationship between the number of people who drowned by falling in swimming pools and the number of Nicolas Cage films. I don't love Nicolas Cage films, but I'm pretty sure that the number of people who drowned by falling into swimming pools is not related to those films. So, of course, we have to be very careful about these casual correlations, right? That's what we would kind of call these. You might also call them crazy correlations. And just one more, because we really are huge geeks. I used to think that correlation implied causation. Then I took a stats class. Now I don't. Sounds like the class helped. Well, maybe. That's so great. Okay, so... I love that so much. So that's why we have to be careful. That's why we care so much about the six checks. That's why understanding the key factors is really, we think about it as something quite different than exploring these casual correlations. We do want to point out really quickly, just because there are some powerful tools that they're not our tools, but tools that are in ArcGIS that can be very valuable if your data is messy. So oftentimes, since the nature of the kind of analysis we're trying to do with regression analysis requires that at each location you have all of the attributes. You have the thing that you're trying to model and then a bunch of other attributes associated with that thing that you're trying to model. So you need a lot of data. And oftentimes our data is messy. So you might have suppressed data. I know any of you that work with health data have seen a map that looks like this, where anywhere you've got, for instance, less than 30 cases or the number of cases doesn't exceed some threshold and it's just suppressed because it would become personally identifiable, or you're missing data for whatever the reason might be, and you want to fill that data in. There are tools to let you do that. One of the tools is a tool called Aerial Interpolation. It's part of the Geostatistical Analyst Extension. And it's a really powerful tool that allows you to take a set of polygons, interpolate that set of polygons into a continuous surface, and then put the values from that interpolated surface into the polygons where you don't have data. And as well as predicting in those unknown locations, it will also give you... an error associated with that prediction that it's given you. So it'll say, you know, I'm predicting that the rate is 10% plus or minus 3%, for instance. And you get not just the prediction, but also the confidence that you have in that prediction. Just worth mentioning, because that is one thing that comes up a lot when you're doing regression analysis, is the this idea of having missing data. So aerial interpolation can help with that. All right, back to business. Okay, so some of you have been with us for quite some time. It's been a long day. It's already 3:30. I'm really sorry. Please do not throw anything at me. We're going to start with this. But we really are actually going to talk about this, but not because it's about the math. We're going to use this kind of like a map so that we're all on the same page about some vocabulary, okay? This is the regression equation, and it's just a useful way for us to talk about how regression analysis works and to get our vocabulary on the same page, because people use different terms to talk about the same thing in regression analysis all the time. We're going to start by talking about the dependent variable. So regression analysis is all about trying to understand our dependent variable, trying to model our dependent variable. It's the y on the left-hand side of the equation, so that makes sense. Everything we're trying to do on the right-hand side is so that we can predict our dependent variable on the left-hand side of our equation. So this is the thing that we're trying to predict or understand. That is our dependent variable. Now, each regression analysis equation will have also explanatory variables. So those are our x's in our equation. And you'll notice there are multiple x's. And that's because our explanatory variables are those variables that we believe explain or are related to our dependent variable. And we have multiple explanatory variables because most of the time, things are complex. And one variable is not going to explain, like if we're talking about Medicare spending, do we really think one variable, like the quality of care, is going to explain how much we spend on Medicare? Probably not. It's probably a pretty complex phenomenon, and we really need to incorporate lots of variables to understand it. And so that's why we see multiple explanatory variables. And we also have coefficients. Now you'll know it's this funny looking B symbol in our equation. And the coefficients, you'll notice each coefficient is associated with one of those explanatory variables. And that's because those coefficients represent the strength and the type of relationship that each explanatory variable has to our dependent variable, right? So if I'm including quality of care in our Medicare example, Medicare spending would be our dependent variable. Quality of care would be our explanatory variable, and we would expect that as the quality of care goes up, Medicare spending might go down, is probably what I would expect, right? We would expect, or maybe it goes up, I don't know. We have an expectation. That relationship, whether it's positive or negative, that relationship is represented as the coefficient. And we can have either a positive relationship, so as obesity rates rise, diabetes rates also rise, right? Or we might have a negative relationship. As foreclosure rates increase, our home values in that area we see decreasing. Or we might have no relationship. And those coefficients in our equation will either be positive or they'll be negative, depending on if it's a positive or a negative relationship. And if it's no relationship, it means it's pretty close to zero. And we'll see how we can interpret whether or not that coefficient is significant or not. And then finally, we have our residuals. These residuals are essentially our model where we are over-predicting and under-predicting. So the whole point of regression analysis, we have this equation. You give us explanatory variables, right? And then you have a dependent variable. And the whole point of regression analysis is that we essentially calibrate the model, create these coefficients so that this equation, and we use our known values for the dependent variable when we're creating this model. Then we drop the dependent variable, and we use just the equation we created to predict that dependent variable. And then we see how good of a job does our model do of predicting, because we know what our dependent values were. So we calibrate the model using all the known information, then we drop our dependent variable and see how good of a job does it do predicting. Now, even though we knew what our dependent variable was, we're still not going to perfectly predict it, because we had to fit an equation that was going to do a good job for all of the locations, right? And because of that, we're always going to have over and under predictions. Because the nature of this equation is it can't go like this. The line that I'm going to draw is never going to go like this. It's a line. And some values will fall above it and some values will fall below it. So we have a predicted value, and we have an observed value, and we're either going to have an over prediction or we're going to have an under prediction. And the output of ordinary least squares regression, when you run it in ArcGIS, is a residual map. So we'll map automatically your over and under predictions. Now, it's not like there's ever going to come some point in time where you've done such a good regression analysis that you have no over and under predictions, right? I can promise you, if you do an analysis and you have no over and under predictions, you have done something wrong. Like, you used Medicare spending to predict Medicare spending, right? You might have no over and under predictions then. But other than that, you're always going to have over and under predictions. The key is, what does the spatial pattern of those over and under predictions look like? Now, that's a different story. But first, we're going to see what ordinary least squares looks like in ArcGIS. Janora is going to show us.
Okay, so back to our Medicare spending example. So we've cut out that hot spot in the south, and we're going to focus on that. But even within this cluster of high spending, we can see that there's some variation. So some areas, these lighter areas, are spending about $8,000 per Medicare beneficiary. These darker areas are spending over $14,000 per Medicare beneficiary. So what we're trying to explain is the variation. What's causing this variation in Medicare spending? So what are some ideas that you guys might have? My first guess was that they were getting better care. That wasn't the case.
Age.
What up? Age.
Underinsured. Those are rural areas, access to medical care.
Access to care, absolutely. Go ahead.
Poverty.
Yeah, socioeconomic, for sure.
Distance from care, absolutely. So the next thing.
Love a good spatial variable.
The next thing we actually thought of was, well, maybe these people in these hotspot areas are actually sicker. And so we're spending more because they're sicker. And so a way to check that is actually by looking at HCC scores, which is it's an index that measures the health of the population and the prevalence of chronic conditions such as asthma, diabetes, heart disease, some types of cancer, those types of things. So I'm actually going to run OLS using HCC scores and see how good of a predictor that is. So my input feature class is going to be my hotspot study area. Give it a unique ID. The dependent variable is going to be those costs, what we're trying to explain. And I'm going to choose average HCC score as my explanatory variable and run OLS. There we go. All right. And as that finishes running, it's just creating the feature layer. But in the messages window and in the result report, the first thing basically it gives us the results of a whole bunch of our diagnostics, those six checks that Lauren's going to talk about in just a moment. But the first thing that I'm going to look for is this adjusted R squared. So it says that our adjusted R squared for this model is 0.65. And so that means that for this area, the HCC score is explaining 65% of the variation in spending that we're seeing in this region.
Which is pretty ridiculous, actually, how great of an R-squared that is. I mean,
depending on the field,
I don't know.
Yeah.
I'm very impressed. It's very annoying to me how good of an R-squared this is with just one variable.
So one of the great things about running this in ArcMap is that you get a spatial output. We get a map output. And so this is a map of our residuals. So these are all the places where the model was underperforming and overperforming. So we can see here, so one of the requirements of OLS in a properly specified model is that your residuals are not clustered. So just visually, we can see here we've got some cluster of overpredictions here and a big cluster of underpredictions here. So I'm not even going to run, so we would run spatial autocorrelation to see if our residuals were in fact clustered, but because we can see that they are in fact clustered, I'm going to skip that step. And I'm going to show you that, so regression and spatial analysis in general is always an iterative process, right? You run it, something's wrong, you run it again. So we did that here, and we did actually find a properly specified model to explain the variation in spending in this area. So let me set this tool up one more time. Our dependent variable is total costs. And we actually found that the number of hospital beds, evaluation and management costs, imaging events like MRIs and CAT scans and that sort of thing, distance to Houston, and dehydration rates actually created the best model in this case. So I'm going to run that tool.
We used Houston in this case. We tried a bunch of different spatial variables. Houston has, I think it is the world's largest medical center, which was one of the reasons that we chose that. But oftentimes, a spatial variable ends up being more of a, it ends up kind of capturing some sort of spatial process that is perhaps measured in some of your socioeconomic or demographic variables. We often find that the key to finding a properly specified model is a spatial variable. So whether it's distance from highway on-ramps or it's distance from the nearest hospital, those kinds of distance variables are often one of the keys to finding a model, not just with good diagnostics here, but with a map of residuals like the one Janora may or may not have just found.
All right, so we are looking at the adjusted R-squared of our properly specified model, and we see that it's now at 0.86. So we've improved improved our R-squared. And just to take a look at those residuals again, visually they look less clustered. They look a little bit more random. But just to double check, it's harder to tell this time. Just to double check, I'm going to go ahead and run spatial autocorrelation on those residuals. And I'm going to go ahead and generate a report and run the tool. And we can see that our report is telling us that those residuals are, in fact, random.
So that's one check. And I guess technically R squared is one check, but probably not the best first check, but I know it's what we all do regardless. So it's a good R squared. And there's no spatial autocorrelation on our residuals, but that's really just one check, and there's six. So what we're going to do is go over all six checks. Okay. So we're going to start by looking at our coefficients. So in this case, what we're talking about is the idea that each of our explanatory variables should support our hypothesis in some way. And one of the things that this is actually the most subjective of the six checks. It's an important check, but it's the one that's the most subjective. And it's the idea that each variable should have the relationship that we expect. And the reason that we put this check in here is because, especially nowadays, it's very easy to run an analysis like this, right? You could throw everything and the kitchen sink into a regression analysis, and you might find some fascinating relationships that mean absolutely nothing. And because of that, we think this is an important check. And the reason and the way that it can end up being very useful is it means that with each variable that you put into your analysis, you have to think about it. What does this variable represent? And what relationship am I expecting it to have with my dependent variable? Now, sometimes it may not have the relationship that you expect, but you have to at least understand why. So when I was working on my master's thesis, I was looking at childhood obesity, and one of the variables that I included is a variable that I called no education, which basically was one of the variables that I found through business analysts, so it's based on the census, and it was no school whatsoever. That was what the variable was, and to me that represented low education levels, as you would expect no school to represent. But then I found that as this is the percentage of the population that with no schooling went up, childhood obesity rates were going down, which made zero sense to me if I thought it actually represented education levels. So because I was going through this check, I went through and I said, this relationship doesn't make any sense. What's going on here? So I had to dig in, look at that variable again, and find that actually what that variable was really correlated with was a high immigrant population. And that what I was seeing was that this no school was just no school in the United States, not kind of recorded, gone through the standard schooling. So what I was finding was that this larger immigrant population was actually leading to perhaps healthier habits, whatever it was, there was an opposite relationship of what I was expecting, and obesity rates, childhood obesity rates were actually lower in those areas, which was fascinating. And as a result of going through this check, it taught me about my variables in a way that I wouldn't have understood or been able to do if I hadn't gone through this check. So it is really important, in large part because we are so kind of data rich, and we have to be really careful that we're being very thoughtful still about the variables that we're including in our analysis. So in this case, the variables had the relationships that we were expecting. So our next check was to make sure that each of our explanatory variables is statistically significant. So you can also think about this, like we want to make sure that each of the explanatory variables we're including are telling an important part of the story. And the way that we gauge if they're telling an important part of the story is by using essentially their statistical significance. If they're not telling an important, if they're not statistically significant, it means essentially that that coefficient is no different than zero. That relationship is not meaningful. And if you took that explanatory variable out, you would expect that your R squared would stay pretty much the same because it's doing essentially nothing in your model. And all you have to do to make sure that each of your variables is statistically significant is make sure that there's an asterisk next to each of these probabilities here. So you're just looking for an asterisk. As long as they all have asterisks, you're good to go and you pass the check. 95%. But there's, sorry, the confidence level is 95%, which is, the report actually says that. And if you're interested, since these tools are Python, you could go in and change the confidence level if you felt so inclined to put the asterisk where the asterisk gets put. I mean, you can clearly tell that what the actual values are, but if you wanted the asterisk to still be there with a 99% confidence, you could change it. Okay, so the next check is about our residuals. Now, we already kind of know that we don't want our residuals to be clustered in space, but we also don't want them to be clustered in value. So the third check is about our clustering of our residuals and using the spatial autocorrelation tool to make sure we don't have clustering. So in this case, we didn't have any clustering. This is one of the toughest checks to pass when you're using spatial data and you're trying to find a properly specified model. It's very common to have spatial autocorrelation in your residuals. And you will have somebody tell you at some point, or it's possible, that it is impossible to find a properly specified model using spatial data and a traditional ordinary least squares regression analysis. You have to use a spatial regression method because there's no way you'll ever find a properly specified model using OLS. I mean, this is a properly specified model. We didn't have any spatial autocorrelation in our residuals. Oftentimes, finding a spatial variable is very important. There's a couple of other techniques that you can use we'll talk about, but it is possible. It's not easy, but it's not easy finding a properly specified model at all. Almost all data is spatial anyway, so that would just mean ordinarily squares just is never, it's never possible to find a model using OLS, but it is. The other thing that is can be very difficult is also about the residuals, and that is this one. You want your residuals to be normally distributed. So what? So if you think about it, you want your residuals in space and in distribution to represent random noise. You don't want there to be any meaningful pattern in your over and under predictions. So in space, we want them to look like random noise. Now, if they were random, what we would expect is that the most of them would be pretty close to zero. And then there'd be more, there'd be less and less of them getting out from zero, and then a couple more bigger or smaller than zero, and more. And what does that create is this normal distribution, right? Centered at zero. That's what these random noise residuals would look like, is normally distributed with a mean of zero. And so we have a test for that called the Hark-Barra statistic. And this is one where we don't want to find an asterisk. An asterisk for this diagnostic would mean that our residuals are not normally distributed. But in this case, they are. This is another one that can be tricky. Those are, in my experience, these two are always the ones that get me. For Hark-Barra, if your residuals are not normally distributed, you might, one of the reasons that that can be is because you may have some relationships that aren't linear. And if your relationships aren't linear, it can cause this skewing of your residuals. But there are some tricks for dealing with that. So if you created a scatter plot of the relationships between your dependent variable and each of your explanatory variable, you might see some relationships that look more like a curved line. There are things that you can do, like essentially transform those variables. You might try squaring them, taking the square root. There's some ways that log them. There's some ways that you can transform those variables so that you can get the relationships to be linear, which can oftentimes deal with this issue of having your residuals not be normally distributed. So in this case, we pass that check. We also want to make sure that each of our coefficients, each of our variables, is telling a different part of the story. So what that means, so if you think about a very common way that regression analysis is often taught is looking at home values. Now, if we're modeling home values, you might think about including a variable like the number of bedrooms. You might think about including a variable like square footage. And what you'd find is that the number of bedrooms and square footage, not always, but in a lot of cases, are two variables that may actually be telling the same part of the story. It's getting at the size of the house, right? So what we have here is a check. It's called the VIF value. It's the variance inflation factor. And what we are looking for are values that are lower than 7.5, but really the lower the better. Some people have a cutoff. Depending on where you look, the cutoff might be 5, might be 10. But the lower, the better for the VIF values. And what you'll find is you're never just going to have one VIF value that's high. Because the whole point of this, what this is testing for is something called multicollinearity or redundancy. Your variables are redundant. They are multicollinear. They're telling the same part of the story. It can cause a lot of problems in your model. So you're going to have at least two high VIF values. That doesn't mean you have to drop both of those variables. What you want to do is drop one of them, run the analysis, see how the model does. You don't expect there to be a big change since they are redundant. They're telling the same part of the story. So you remove one, run the analysis, see how good your R squared still is, see how good the other diagnostics are, then switch it. Put that one back, take the other one out, and just keep in whichever one does a slightly better job of telling that piece of the story in your model until you have no multicollinearity and you get rid of that redundancy and all your VIF values are lower than 7.5. So the last check that we talk about is R-squared and evaluating model performance. Now, these actually don't have any sort of order to them. Each one of them is equally important, and you can do them in whatever order you want. You can check your R-squared first. You could have a 0.99 R-squared. If you have spatial autocorrelation of your residuals and you wait till the end to check it, that's your problem. Ultimately, you still can't trust your R-squared. Each one of these checks has to pass in order for you to have a model that you can trust, right? So we put R squared last just because while it's important, it doesn't matter how good your R squared is if you can't trust the model. So this is actually the other place where there's a little bit of subjectivity, right? What does it mean for the R squared to be good enough? And this is where you're really going to have to think about and do some research and kind of know the field that you're doing this research in. If you're doing regression analysis in anything related to predicting people, I mean, if you're talking about human, anything related to, I guess, human geography, I mean, 0.86 is like, we were literally doing a dance, right? When we saw this value. If you were looking at drug testing, right? If you're in medicine and you're testing a new drug, it's like 0.99999. You have to have R squared. It's like off the charts high R squared. So there's a very different threshold depending on the field and depending on what you're researching. So it's very important in this case that you understand what is appropriate or acceptable based on the field that you're looking at. Now, I do think it's important to say that the online help is surprisingly helpful. We have worked really hard. One of our colleagues, Lauren Scott, wrote the bulk of our regression analysis documentation. And it's, since I didn't write it, I can say, it's like the best doc in the entire, out of all of the ArcGIS doc. I don't think there's any better documentation about regression analysis anywhere. There's one of the topics is called Regression Analysis Basics, and it's just such a great explanation of what regression analysis is, how it all works. There's just so much information there. So all of the stuff we're talking about today, it's a lot, right? These six checks and how regression analysis works, it's all in the documentation. There's so many resources, including things like this table here that shows you like, oh, I've got my residuals aren't normally distributed. What do I do? Why is that a problem? And then, oh, you should try transforming your variables. So it gives you this idea of common problems that you may run into and what are some solutions for those problems. So a lot of really useful documentation. Okay, so Janora kind of glazed over this. We said we did a dance when we found this model, and that's because finding a model is not easy at all, right? Okay, so those of you who said that you do regression analysis regularly, am I right? Like finding a model is hard, right? Yeah, it's hard. And there's nothing I can do to tell you it's not going to be hard. You're not, I can almost guarantee you're not going to run once, find a properly specified model, and call it a day. It is an iterative process. Now, our iterative process has evolved to incorporate a tool called exploratory regression. Exploratory regression essentially is a tool that will take, it will test all the different combinations of variables that you think might be related to your dependent variable. It's kind of like stepwise regression, except that it actually tests all the different combinations. Stepwise regression is focusing on R squared and eliminating combinations that it's not going to try because they won't yield high R squareds. We test all the combinations, but we're checking for all six checks. Well, we can't check for all six checks because we can't check to see if the relationship is what you expect, but we're making sure that the residuals are normally distributed. We're making sure that the variables are all significant. We're making sure that there's no multicollinearity in our checks, and so we will spit out properly specified models, essentially. We're even checking for spatial autocorrelation of the residuals if you pass the other checks. So it's a tool that tests these combinations. There are trade-offs. There are two camps, I think, when it comes to this kind of, it's essentially data mining, right? And there's two camps, and you fall in one or the other, or where we fall, which is kind of in the middle, that kind of the traditional way of thinking about this kind of hypothesis. You go into a regression analysis, you have the five variables you think are related, you run your regression analysis, and then whatever the relationships are, whatever the results are, that's the result of your analysis, and that's what you write up and publish about. And that's a very traditional kind of conservative way, like you have a hypothesis, this is what you put into your model, and that is it. You don't try any other combinations, that's your hypothesis. The other side of it is I'm going to literally throw every single census variable that's ever been collected, as well as all the variables I collected, and basically every single piece of data I can possibly find on the plane, I'm going to shove it into this tool and just see what happens. We find ourselves somewhere in the middle where you do want to think meaningfully about the variables you include, but still maybe have a little room for exploring the data and mining. So it, you kind of have to see where you lie. But Janora is just going to show you briefly what exploratory regression looks like in ArcGIS, because it is pretty awesome.
It is awesome, and it's also very easy. So we,
easier.
Easy-ish. So we input our hotspot study area again, and our dependent variable is, again, total cost. But this time, we're just going to select all of our variables in this feature class. And then I'm just going to take out the ones that we know aren't going to matter, like unique ID. We can't explain total cost by total cost, but that's not
cheating.
Appropriate and cheating. And then I'm also going to take out the shape length, shape area, things that we know don't matter. And then I am going to save an output report file on my desktop. And I'm going to run the tool. And even before the tool stops running, we can take a peek and see what's happening.
You can see some very impatient people design this tool.
Okay. Oh, it says it's completed, so we'll just go ahead and look at the actual report. It completed before I even...
It can take some time. If you're including, like, 50 variables, I've had this run for hours, and I'll go to lunch, and I come back, and I'm, like, looking at what's the latest that's been spit out.
Okay, so in that output report, you can see that it chose. So first, it tried each variable by itself. Then it tried each combination of two variables, each combination of three variables. If we had had any passing models, they would have shown up here underneath passing models. So finally, at four variables, we see some passing models. And then in our combination of five variables, we see. The one that I showed you earlier with OLS that is properly specified, that has a number of hospital beds, evaluation and management costs, imaging IDs, distance to Houston, and our dehydration rates. and it also has the highest adjusted R-squared. So even if you run exploratory regression with 5 variables or like 17 variables and don't find any passing models, this report actually does, it includes a lot of really helpful information anyways, such as the summary of variable significance. So we can see here the average HCC score was significant 100% of the time, and it was had a positive relationship 100% of the time. So that might be a variable that you want to keep. You don't want to throw that one away. But something like this procedure events per 1,000, it was only significant 60% of the time, and like about a third of the time it was had a negative relationship, and then about two-thirds of the time it was positive. So that might be one that you would maybe reserve and not include in your analysis going forward.
And the reason you'd be kind of throwing things out is if you did start with like 40 and it was taking a while to run, you might try to pare it down using this understanding of which variables are showing up as significant often, which ones seem the most stable, just because like we'll start, you get to decide, is it going to try models with 2 variables, 3 variables, 4 variables? You could go up to 10 variables. It'll just take a long time. It's the number of combinations it's trying, then as you increase the number of variables in each model is a lot. I mean, how many combinations does it tell you just ran? Like thousands?
I don't know. I just closed.
It tells you how many combinations it tried, but it's just like it very quickly becomes a lot of models. So if you're going to try a lot of variables, sometimes we'll start with just where it's trying models with just 3 variables, and then we'll take a look at some of those diagnostics and then decide which ones to cut down so that we can move on to the next ones. All right. So, they are fixed, so you'd have to transform your variables up front if you wanted to include some transformed variables in there. That would be cool, though. Okay, so at this point, we've really talked about traditional ordinary least squares regression, and we do that because we think it's a really important place to start in your regression analysis process. It's also one of the most powerful regression analysis tools because of its simplicity. In its simplicity, there is this incredible power because of how rich these diagnostics are, because of how long it has been used and how good of a job it does. It's just a very powerful model. If you can find a good OLS model, you are so golden, right? But we haven't incorporated geography, and there's a lot that we can gain by incorporating geography. So what is the difference between OLS and GWR? One is a global model and one is a local model. Now, these are both linear regression methods, okay? The difference is one's global and one's local. OLS is a global regression model. So what that means is that when you run OLS, we looked at that equation. One equation is being calculated for your entire study area, right? So when we're looking at this area in the southeast of the United States, that regression equation with the coefficients and our explanatory variables and our residuals, that one regression equation fits for the entire southeast of the United States, right? So that means that the coefficient between the relationship between imaging events and Medicare spending is the same everywhere because there's just one equation. Now, with a local regression method like GWR, it's actually a local regression model. So what that means is that it goes to each feature and it calculates an equation based on its neighboring features. So every single feature in your data set ends up with a different equation, which means that every feature has a different coefficient for every variable. So the relationship between imaging and spending over here could actually be different than the relationship between imaging and spending over here, because the relationships are allowed to vary over space, because you're calibrating a different model in each location. So each feature gets a separate equation based on its neighborhood. And luckily, we don't ever have to look at it this way, but it just helps me to think about it this way, which seems crazy now that I'm saying it out loud, but it does. This is how I think about it. Each one of those features has its own equation, which actually ends up being incredibly powerful. So Janora is going to show us GWR.
All right. So we're not actually going to start over as far as variables go. I'm going to input my study area. The dependent variable is still our total costs. And our explanatory variables are going to be those same evaluation and management costs, number of hospital beds, distance to Houston, imaging events, and dehydration rates. Add 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Okay, I got them all.
And this is really important. I mean, the reason that we start with OLS, well, another reason that we start with OLS is because, and the reason that we stress it so much in this workshop is because of this step. You don't start over. You use the results of that OLS and that properly specified model. That's what you use to move on to GWR and see if you can improve your model using GWR.
And part of that reason is, like, starting with a properly specified OLS model is because you might notice you get a whole lot less diagnostics and information about your model using GWR.
So one of the criticisms of GWR, and as you know, every method has its critics, and people love GWR, they don't love GWR. One of the criticisms of GWR is that there's a lot less diagnostics. But the truth is that's true in a lot of regression methods that people are using these days that aren't OLS. There's a lot of methods out there with a lot less diagnostics, and that's they can be very powerful. They can be very, very effective from a predictive standpoint. But when we want to understand relationships, we have to be very careful about having diagnostics and feeling confident about the model that we're finding. And so that's why we take a bit of a conservative stance. You'll find lots of people who don't go through this workflow of starting with OLS before moving on to GWR. We take a bit of a conservative stance from in this context and really recommend this workflow for that reason.
One other thing about this report is that we can now see that our adjusted R-squared has gone up to about 88%. So we've actually improved our R-squared by allowing those coefficients to vary across space and allowing those equations to vary throughout our study area. So the output of GWR is also a map of residuals. But one of the more interesting things, I think, is actually to map the coefficients. So I'm just going to go in here and change the symbology really quickly. And graduated colors. So let's look at the coefficient for imaging events. And let me change this. All right, so now we can see the coefficients over our study area. This is really important because if you wanted to actually implement something and impact Medicare spending in this area, you could see from the coefficients that you might want to target excessive imaging events or unnecessary imaging events, and you might want to focus your resources in this area here because that is where imaging events are having more of an impact on Medicare costs than, say, in this part of southern Texas. Just one more example, let's look at dehydration rates. So if you were going to raise awareness about the dangers of dehydration and making sure everybody knew how important it was to stay hydrated, you might want to focus your efforts and your resources in this area because it's in this area that dehydration rates actually impact Medicare costs, whereas it's less important for that kind of cluster or core of imaging events.
And it's not that this isn't saying that that's where Medicare spending is higher, and it's not saying that that's where dehydration events are higher. It's saying that that's where the relationship between Medicare spending and dehydration events is strongest. And that's a big distinction, right? This is about mapping the relationship between those factors, which is really, really powerful when it comes to kind of policy. And even just understanding and exploring the relationships, it's really powerful to be able to explore these relationships spatially. So just a couple more details about GWR. So we talked about the fact that GWR is a local spatial regression model and that we use the same variables from OLS. There are some exceptions. One of the things that you might do when you're running an OLS is use something like so we talked about spatial variables, and a spatial variable like the distance from a highway on-ramp would be a great one, and you could still include it in GWR because that would vary a lot over space. If you include a dummy variable like a spatial regime variable like urban-rural, where you have an entire region of your study area that's just zeros and another area of your study area that you gave it a one, and you use that variable as a dummy variable in your OLS model, you would not want to use that when you move to GWR. GWR requires, because it's calibrating the model locally, it requires that you have a good amount of spatial variation in the values that you're looking at. So the good news is you have to drop that variable. The good news is that GWR is going to pick that up anyway. Because of the nature of the local nature of the method, it's going to find that urban-rural pattern just by the nature of looking only locally. So you shouldn't really lose much by dropping that dummy variable. And again, you can't include variables that have very little value variation over space. The model just will not be able to solve. Now we do, because it's a local model, we do have to think about how to define local. There's two ways to think about it. One, there's a parameter about kernel type. There's two options, which are fixed and adaptive. Fixed essentially means it's going to use one distance and go around with this essentially a fixed distance band, a search radius, and look at features in that way. Adaptive means it's going to use a particular number of neighbors. It's called adaptive because over here 16 neighbors might look like this, and over here it might look like this. It's still 16 neighbors, but it's adapting the size of it based on the number of neighbors. And then you can choose what your bandwidth method is. So that's the method that is going to be used to determine either what the right fixed distance is going to be or the right number of neighbors. Now, there's actually really great defaults in GWR. There's two methods that will choose a default for you, AIC and cross-validation, two methods that will essentially, regardless of which one you choose, what they're essentially trying to do is pick either a number of neighbors or a distance band that's going to optimize your model. And it does a pretty good job, and you'll find that they end up getting to pretty similar either neighborhood distances or numbers of neighbors. So I basically always accept the default there. They have I never pick my own distance and get a model that's as good as what it picks with AIC or cross-validation. And then we showed mapping coefficients, but there's actually some other things that you can map also. So the default is to map the residuals. There's also this idea of mapping the local R-squared. So one thing that we've done as an exploratory analysis, like let's say you're working on your master's thesis modeling childhood obesity, and you can't find a properly specified model for the life of you. Well, one thing you could do is use GWR to explore the relationship. So I ran GWR just on one of the models that I was finding in OLS that was higher, like 0.3 R squared. And I wanted to see where was the model doing a good job and where wasn't it doing a good job. Because I thought maybe if I could map those local R squareds, I'd have a light bulb moment about what variable I was missing. You know, oh, of course, I'm not doing a good job over here because I haven't thought about this variable that I should have included. And so mapping these can also be part of the analysis process of finding a properly specified model in the first place. Because and the same way, we map the residuals for OLS and for GWR, and it's not just about running that test for spatial autocorrelation. If you have a lot of clustering of overpredictions, you can also use that map to help you try to figure out what variables you're missing. Because most of the time, the reason you have that clustering is because you're missing a key explanatory variable. And if you can use that map to guide figuring out what variables are missing, that can be really useful. So the maps serve more of a purpose than just kind of policy decisions on the back end. It can also be in the beginning stages where you're doing that kind of exploration and iterative analysis. Because it is, even with exploratory regression, it's an iterative process. I've never put all my variables in, run exploratory regression once, and found the perfect model. It's still iterative. And I guess to close on kind of a high note, this idea, essentially all models are wrong, but some are useful. And I think that's very true, very poetic. And with that, we'll take some questions and we'll point you to our resources, esriurl.com/spatialstats. I didn't change the last slide to put Janora's email. And I would never miss out on the opportunity for her to also be helpful to you guys. Okay. So with that, thank you very much. If you've been here with us, has anyone been here with us like since 8:30 this morning? You guys are so awesome. Thank you so much. We love you guys. I hope you are excited about spatial stats and that you feel like you got something out of the day. And hope you have a great rest of the conference. Uh-huh. The definition of? Oh, yeah. Although these slides are all up on our resources page. Everyone's brain is basically about to explode. I understand that. Sure. Yeah. So the question is, what's the condition number? Yeah, that's a great question. You don't want to have you want to look at that output and see if you have condition numbers above 30. If your condition number is above 30, it does really pretty much invalidate your results. And one of the things I kind of think about that condition number is like how hard it was for the model to solve. And there is no, like, it's one of the only diagnostics, and so it is an important one. Yeah, it's a good one. And mapping it can actually be a really good hint, too, about where you might have, it can be another clue about what you might be missing. Mm-hmm.
Excellent presentation. A couple basic questions. I noticed you were using ARC Pro. The same tools exist in ARC Map, and if so, which versions? Most recent ones, number one. Number two, your input data, is it raster or vector, or can you use both?
Okay. First question, we were in Pro, and actually this is the first year we've only demoed in Pro. But these tools are available in ArcMap. These tools have been around for, I think exploratory regression was like 10.0 or 10.1. It's always so hard to remember, and now it's getting worse because I don't know if you guys have noticed, but I've noticed we're releasing Pro like 3 times a year, which might not sound like a big deal to you, but it's a big deal to us. So lots of releases very quickly, but yeah, both are available in both places. And the input is vector. So if you have rasters, you'd have to do some sort of transformation, but you'd have to be very careful about that because if you have a lot of data redundancy, I mean, what happens with rasters if you have whole swaths of area that have the same value? It's a quick way to get issues with, particularly with GWR, with local multicollinearity. So you have to be really careful about the redundancy in raster data. So you want, it'll work on points, lines, and polygons. Basically, your feature class has to have your dependent variable and all of your explanatory variables for each feature in one feature class. Mm-hmm. Oh. Dummy variables. Yep.
So how are you going to incorporate the categorical variables?
So the question was about categorical variables, which it's true. The only way to incorporate categorical variables in OLS is as dummy variables. You know, if you had urban, suburban, rural, you'd do zeros and ones for each. You'd have an urban, a suburban, and a rural. Depending on the categorical data and how spatially varied it is, you might be able to get away with it. Because the whole reason you can't include dummy variables is because you can't have a big chunk of your data that has the exact same value. But if you had 18 categories or something and you were including all of them and there wasn't huge swaths of area with the exact same value, you might be able to get away with it. But the analysis will not run because it just can't. It's trying to solve and it won't be able to solve. So unfortunately, you could think about, if you've got categorical, like sometimes we'll end up with categorical variables because it's some sort of a survey, and at the individual you've got categories. One thing you might think about is aggregating up. So instead of it being a 0-1 for the category, it's the number of people who answered this way, or it's the percentage of people that answered this way. So kind of converting those categories into counts or percentages might be one. If you kind of aggregate above the level at which you have the category, you might be able to end up with some counts or rates that could work.
Mm-hmm. How do you move from a different R squared value for every feature? Like, how does that boil down to one R squared value for your entire GWR model?
It's a good question. I've had long conversations about this with one of my favorite statisticians down the hall from me. There's a way it happens magically. If you really want the in-depth answer, I can point you to the right person to give it to you. Oh, sorry. The question was, how do you move from all these local R-squareds to GWR reporting one single R-squared? And it's a good question, which on various occasions in my life, I have known the answer to really well. This is not one of those times.
Are you talking about Eric?
Yeah, so Eric Krause, who is often at the booth and is just awesome, is one of our favorite stats guys. And we know exactly how it works. It's just, it's very mathy. Which you knew.
There's a question over there.
Uh-huh. So the question is, can you look at the histograms and can you do transformations? Yes and yes. I mean, the transformations, it's just like field calculator stuff. There's no tool to do an automatic log of everything, although you could do a model or write a simple Python script to do it. The histograms, you can use charts to create histograms. Flora loves that question because now you can chart in both ArcMap and Pro. So any of those can be turned into a chart. In ArcMap, there's actually a scatter plot matrix. Is that on the list for Pro? It's on the list. Oh, sorry. She asked for histogram. But the scatterplot matrix actually shows the histograms, too. So, yeah, you can in ArcMap, you can actually look at, an 8x8 matrix of histograms and scatterplots, which is pretty awesome. If you just go to insert chart, I think, and then you have the option for a scatterplot matrix. Well, thank you, guys.